This is moving Alaska's gas interest forward for us as Alaskans and maximizing that interest for years ahead.
The governor praises a settlement on Point Thompson as the way toward gas line development. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Alaskan is dropped from an FCC board amid questions about what happened.
It's unfortunate that because of whatever has gone on post-nomination, we are now not going to have an Alaskan on that board.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The Association of Alaska School Boards believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
Governor Sean Parnell today announced what is likely to be seen as a milestone in the development of North Slope Liquefied Natural Gas, or LNG. He says litigation concerning the development of Point Thompson on the eastern North Slope has been settled, and three major producers are now aligned with the Alaska Pipeline Project to focus on completion of a gas line from the North Slope to Tidewater and export to Pacific Rim customers. Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan was on hand to explain.
This agreement does not guarantee a major gas line for Alaska, but it certainly moves us a significant step closer. The IPS required by the agreement and the full field development alternatives set forth in the agreement all serve as a pre-investment on the ultimate goal of large-scale commercialization of gas from the North Slope.
The announcement follows a meeting of the top CEOs of ConocoPhillips, BP, Exxon, and the governor in January. Point Thompson litigation goes back to 2005, when then-Governor Frank Murkowski began the process of taking state leases away from ExxonMobil for not taking steps to develop the field. With the settlement now in place, Governor Parnell says the state can finally begin moving forward. The governor noted that Point Thompson gas must be combined with Prudhoe Bay gas to maximize the long-term interests of the state.
If we can get the state off of, you know, going six different directions and consolidate into two that can then merge into a gas line, we will have a gas line sooner in Alaska's interest than if we spend our time trying to spray a shotgun shell, you know, as opposed to this more targeted approach. So bottom line is, this is moving Alaska's gas interest forward for us as Alaskans and maximizing that interest for years ahead.
Responding to questions from reporters, Parnell said the settlement is not linked to House Bill 110, the measure currently stalled in the legislature that would give major tax breaks to the industry for increased production.
HB 110 addresses oil taxes. One of my benchmarks that I set forth in the State of the State was that if these benchmarks for progress are met, if these companies resolve Point Thompson, get alignment on a gas line, meet together with AGDC, and meet those benchmarks in the State of the State for this year, which the next set of benchmarks are due in the fall, as an administration, we would be ready to work with legislators on gas taxes next year, in 2013, to move forward on a gas line.
Commissioner Sullivan explained that the settlement was designed to motivate the corporations involved to move steadily toward production. He says the settlement documents include several safeguards for the state, primarily that if work does not continue toward producing from Point Thompson, the state gets the leases back without needing further litigation. It lays out timelines and benchmarks companies must meet, such as the development of initial production systems, or IPS. That's the near-term production that the companies have agreed to, 10,000 barrels a day by 2016.
If the companies don't either sanction a major gas sale or commit to one of these, then they will have automatic contraction of significant acreage from Point Thompson. For some reason, they don't follow through on the IPS or do any of the alternatives. Even though there's producing wells on certain leases, we have a provision in there that says we get it all back, all of it, by 2019, including the leases with the producing wells on.
getting the LNG to market is still years away, according to Parnell and Sullivan. They estimate that the development of Point Thompson under the new agreement provides potential for significant gas volumes for in-state use by 2019. The long-term plan is to pipe the LNG to a south central port for sale in Asian markets. Alaskan villagers say it's time to crack down on the pollock trawl fleet because it is intercepting too many salmon bound for their rivers. This week, they have been pressuring the North Pacific Fishery Management Council on the bycatch issue, but the council is still examining its options and plans no action during its spring meeting, which continues through the weekend in Anchorage. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Salmon are a prohibited species for the trawlers, but that doesn't mean they get shut down if they catch them. It does mean they can't sell them, and if they intercept enough of them, regulatory action swings in. Now, what regulatory action is up to the council? The bycatch can fluctuate wildly from year to year. For instance, in 2010, the Bering Sea pollock fleet caught only 13,000 chum salmon. But last year, the chum bycatch soared to 191,445 fish. Genetic studies are showing that many of those chums may have been bound for hatcheries in Japan and Russia rather than rivers in Alaska. Jeff Goyon of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Laboratory in Auk Bay will not have an analysis of last year's bycatch until next year, but he did give the council his results from 2010.
So these are the stock composition results that we had from the available 1,000 or so samples from 2010. A lot of the samples that we had were derived from East Asia, Japan, and North Asia, Russia. So this is over 60% of the chum salmon.
But that is a small sample compared to last year's, at a time when everyone knows the ecosystem has been shifting. The council had been concentrating more on the Chinook salmon bycatch, and that was contained to less than 30,000 fish in the Bering Sea last year. But in the Gulf of Alaska, in 2010, the Chinook bycatch hit its highest level in more than a decade, then dropped back down last year. Meanwhile, Chinook salmon runs on both the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers have been troubled since the 1990s, bringing about frequent closures. This, plus the arrival of more processing capacity, has increased dependence in the villages on chums. When federal fisheries managers began the tribal consultation process ordered by President Obama, they quickly got a unified message from the villages. The villages want a hard cap on the chum salmon bycatch of 30,000 fish. This means they want the pollock fleet shut down if it hits that cap. Here's how Pollock Simon Jr. of Ellicacket, on a tributary of the Yukon, put it.
But I'd like to see the cut across the board. If we river visitors are cut back in fishing, the high sea fisherman has to take his cut also.
That is not even on the table right now. The council is looking at three alternatives and not planning final action on any of them this spring. One of the alternatives does involve a hard cap, but it would be higher at 50,000 chum or more. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
An Alaskan appointed to a Federal Communications Commission board was dropped after a letter from Governor Sean Parnell's chief of staff asked for a change. In early March, Senator Mark Begich's staff put forth the name of Jim Kohler for a place on the Technical Advisory Board for First Responder Interoperability. That board deals with connectivity for a national public safety broadband network. Kohler is Alaska's Deputy Director of Enterprise Technology Services for the State Department of Administration. Begich spokeswoman Julie Haskett says they worked with the governor's D.C. staff on the nomination.
We had reached out to the governor's office in D.C. and said that we were considering nominating Mr. Kohler for this board because he had been the person that we deal with on telecom issues in D.C. And the governor's office in D.C. basically said, great idea. We think that's a good idea to support him for the nomination. We will work with you.
Haskett says Kohler seemed ideal for the position, and he was accepted to the board.
And then it looks like that's not happening. So it's just a big disappointment. We're not sure what happened because we were working with the governor's office, and now they have withdrawn his name.
Senator Begich sent the nomination letter to the FCC on March 7th. On the 22nd, the FCC sent out a public notice naming all the board appointees. That list included Jim Kohler's name, along with 13 others from states across the country. But on March 26th, Governor Parnell's Chief of Staff, Mike Nizek, sent a strongly worded letter to FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski, saying Kohler was not the governor's choice, and asked that Matthew Levesque, Deputy Director of the State Troopers, be placed on the board instead. The result? The FCC removed Kohler and replaced him with someone from the lower 48, leaving Alaska out. Julie Haskett says that's a disappointment.
Anytime you have an opportunity to get an Alaskan on a national board that's going to be discussing the future of telecommunications and broadband, that seems like a great opportunity because we always feel like we want the Alaska story told and the Alaska issues understood. So again, it's unfortunate that because of whatever has gone on post-nomination, we are now not going to have an Alaskan on that board.
Parnell staff in D.C. and Alaska did not return repeated emails and calls this week for this story. Kohler serves on the Alaska Broadband Task Force with 20 other Alaskans, including Senator Joe Pascavan, a Democrat from Fairbanks. Pascavan has written to Governor Parnell requesting an explanation. The Begich and Nizek letters and FCC notice are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the bizarre world of writing a police blotter.
Woman reported receiving an odd call on her business line from a mumbling man who identified himself as Frankenstein and made about as much sense as same.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Still no herring fishery in Sitka, where the fleet remained on two-hour notice for a fourth day today. More samples will be taken tomorrow to see if the roe inside the herring is mature enough to harvest. When a fishery is called, it will be the fleet's first go at 29,000 tons of the small silverfish. The guideline harvest level is 10,000 more tons than last year. That could be good news for the 48 permit holders in one of Alaska's most lucrative fisheries. But it also raises concerns with Sitka's local tribal government, which has mounted a publicity campaign to protest the high harvest limit. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
The big jump comes after the state corrected the way it ages the herring. An error in determining age meant that scientists were underestimating the biomass and therefore setting a lower harvest level. Fish and Game says, in essence, the increase in the harvest level is setting the bar back where it should have been all along. But the Sitka Tribe of Alaska disagrees, and it has taken to newspapers throughout southeast Alaska to say so. A series of ads placed in the Sitka Sentinel, the Ketchikan Daily News, and the Juneau Empire state that 29,000 tons is roughly equal to 58 million pounds, and one of the ads claims that that is enough herring to cover a football field in 20 feet of the silverfish. The ads call the harvest excessive.
Our concern is we wanted people to visualize what was being removed from the waters around Sitka and then to begin to question if those overall biomass numbers are correct.
Jeff Feldpausch is Resource Protection Director for the Sitka Tribe. Fish and Game points out that the harvest is only ever 20% of the entire biomass. The tribe has doubts about the state's methodology. Feldpausch says the state's data is based on three-year-old herring.
So that means there's 2-3 years of data that they don't know what's happening out there. And a precipitous decline in those particular years, brood years, won't be caught in the model until they hit age three. So you could be significantly over-harvesting these fish and not know it for several years.
Well, I think the Department of Fish and Game has the best management and science anywhere in Alaska or anywhere in the Pacific Northwest.
Steve Reifenstuhl is executive director of the Southeast Herring Conservation Alliance, which represents the commercial fleet.
When the Department of Fish and Game took over management in the 60s, when we became a state, the biomass for the Sitka Sound herring was around 5,000 tons or a little less. Today, it's in excess of 145,000 tons, over a 20-fold increase.
The tribe and the commercial fleet have found some common ground. A deal struck at the State Board of Fisheries meeting last month set up a subsistence-only zone in Sitka Sound. Roughly, the zone is between the southern portion of Middle Island and all the way down to the breakwater at the north end of Sitka Channel. Reifenstuhl says it was a good compromise.
It demonstrates that both sides were willing to come to the middle, even if they disagreed about the parameters. And I think that really at this time, is time for healing.
The final zone is smaller than the tribe's original request, but Feldpausch says it's still considered a victory. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
U.S. Senators Mark Begich and Washington's Maria Cantwell want the federal government to quickly look into the potential impacts of tsunami-generated debris. The Democrats held a press conference today in Seattle. They called for President Barack Obama to release National Science Foundation emergency research funds. That would help scientists hone in on what needs to be done to prepare for the debris. Begich says Alaska already has a problem with trash piling up on outer coast beaches.
The impacts of debris coming ashore, maybe from tsunami or otherwise, have enormous impact to our fishing industry, our recreational industry, our shipping, commercial industry, you name it, it will have an impact. So ensuring that we have the right resources, the right information, the right science is critical for us to plan and be prepared for whatever level the tsunami debris moves and comes close to our shores.
It's been a year since a devastating earthquake hit Japan, sending up to 100,000 tons of tsunami-generated debris into the Pacific Ocean. Oysterbuoys, damaged ships, and other junk have already been found from southeast Alaska's Prince of Wales Island to the Aleutians. Cantwell cited a derelict fishing boat spotted this week near northern British Columbia as an example of what's to come. The senators voiced their concerns in a letter to Obama. They also criticized a proposed 25% cut in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's funding for shoreline cleanup. The governor will likely get a scholarship bill from the Senate this session, but it might not be the one he wants. The Senate Finance Committee today approved a plan setting into place the method for granting financial assistance for graduates of Alaska's high schools who want to attend an in-state university or vocational school. It will open a way to spend the earnings of a $400 million fund set up by the legislature last year. The governor originally presented the scholarship for students who meet a strict course of study and performance. An issue arose, however, of how to provide support for those students who, for various reasons, do not meet those prescribed standards. The Senate version of the bill will allow students with GED high school equivalency diplomas to qualify for assistance and will require exceptions be given to students who were unable to meet the governor's standard because of illness or because the local school did not offer the coursework necessary. Diane Behrens, the executive director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, said the administration has some concerns about the changes the Senate made.
The governor remains very committed to the program that he has been an advocate for the last 2 years. So we are very interested in seeing a fund established, but we would like to do so without a dilution of the message behind the Alaska Performance Scholarship.
Under the bill, two-thirds of the money from the earnings of the Higher Education Investment Fund will go to performance scholarships for those graduates who qualify under the governor's standards. The other third will be set aside for the Alaska Advantage Scholarship for those who use an alternative method of qualifying. The bill will next appear on the Senate floor.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Emily Schwing. This week on AK, crime writing. Eagle attacks, drunken mishaps, and intimate encounters gone horribly wrong. These are just a few of the reasons that people across the state look forward to the Unalaska Police Blotter. But the joy of the blotter isn't just in the ridiculous items it contains. It's in the way that Sergeant Jennifer Shockley writes about them. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez introduces us to Alaska's most literary police officer.
When Sergeant Jennifer Shockley heads out on patrol, she's got the blotter on her mind. Her goal is to paint a detailed picture of the town's often bizarre crimes.
I can only imagine that somebody who's never been here would think that this was some kind of Twilight Zone town where every form of, you know, human oddity and absurdity exists all at once, exacerbated by alcohol.
Twilight Zone is an understatement. Since Shockley first started compiling the blotter 6 years ago, she's written about feral horses chasing down cyclists and ravenous prowlers who steal boxes of handkerchiefs, only to be discovered by the trail of blood and pizza they left behind. Crime in Unalaska is mostly innocuous, and names are never used in the blotter unless a person is charged. That gives Shockley some creative license. Take this item, for example.
Domestic disturbance. A grown man asked an officer to tell his grown dipsomaniac son to go Betty-bye. The officer helped the drunk to bed, but declined the request to feed the family cat on his way out.
Or this one, about a routine animal complaint.
Petite piles of poo prompted protest to police.
The Unalaska blotter is often so outrageous that it even makes Shockley chuckle. It's strewn with words like ruffian, sternutation, belligerent, and lout, and each item is like its own tiny novella. That great storytelling has earned Shockley a global following, with mentions on Jay Leno and in the LA Times. Sheila Toomey writes Alaska Ear, a popular column that runs in the Anchorage Daily News and often ends with some of Shockley's more entertaining items. As a former crime reporter, Toomey has an especially deep appreciation for Shockley's humor.
She has an advantage over a lot of other newspapers in that so many of the police calls out there include the phrase, alcohol was involved. And you know, if it's not a serious crime, if there's no, you know, blood on the sidewalk, all you have to do is quote what a drunk says or describe in refined language what he does, and you've got a winner.
Toomey says that she can't name the best blotter item. There are too many to choose from. But there was something involving a domestic disturbance, a towel, and a rather abashed apology a few weeks ago that made her laugh.
The recent one about the noise complaint that turned out to be people making love a little too lustily was a favorite.
While Shockley is beloved by writers like Toomey, she's never attempted to make a job of it herself. Shockley got her degree in wildlife science in Texas, then joined the Peace Corps in Cameroon. She's also worked as a Bering Sea Fisheries Observer, a United Nations officer in Kosovo, and toyed with the idea of becoming a game warden, all before becoming the voice of the Unalaska Department of Public Safety. When I sit down with Shockley in her office, she reminisces about the Dracula crimes from 3 years ago, where a man under the influence of something bit his roommate and claimed to be a vampire. She also reads me this Mary Shelley-influenced item.
Woman reported receiving an odd call on her business line from a mumbling man who identified himself as Frankenstein and made about as much sense as same.
It's weird stuff like that that cracks her up, she says as she starts to type up this week's blotter. Most items in there are actually summaries of other officers' incident reports. Shockley says her method for injecting life into these write-ups is pretty simple.
Read them. Convert them into something that is only two or three sentences long, that uses interesting words, and paints a psychedelic picture of our community.
When Shockley was first assigned the blotter in 2006, she wasn't given much room to play. But within a year, she was pushing the envelope and spicing items up with the kind of words that could jack up a high schooler's SAT score. The reaction was positive, and the blotter has since become an almost untouchable institution. Ghostwriters imitate Shockley's style when she takes vacation, and the current police chief edits less than 5% of what's written. With a secure position and a wide readership, Shockley wants to get even more creative, trying to sneak in things like palindromes. And while she mostly works in prose, she now sees any minor incident as a poem waiting to happen.
There is a situation out there just waiting to be made into a limerick.
And when that situation does arise, it will probably involve alcohol. For AK, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're headed for Eek, a small village west of Bethel near the Bering Sea coast.
My name is Fritz Petluska. I'm the city clerk for the city of Eek. Oh, we're located like about 38 miles south of Bethel. I'm not sure exactly when, Eek became a village, but I think it was 1970 where, we subsist and, gather wood and fishing and, hunting caribou, but it's closed now, so. Gas is like $7 a gallon. It's expensive. Plus, in January, I bet you each household was buying, drums of fuel every week. Houses that don't have, wood stoves. And we're going to run out of fuel here, because of January. Because it was cold the whole month. Yeah, we have a little bit left, but, I'm pretty sure that we're going to have to go up to Bethel and get maybe a drum, I think the wind chill was, I don't think in January it never gotten above 30 below. Closed school for like maybe 2-3 days because, the wind chill was like over, it was well under 50, so.
Fritz Petluska is the city clerk for Eek. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Alexandra Gutierrez, Heather Arono, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Emily Schwing. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Emily Schwing was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.